Do you want a drink?
In a minute. I just wanted to sit there, to let my head rest against Patrick. I wanted to feel like I used to feel, normal, untroubled. I wanted not to think about death.
I broke my best time today. 15 miles in just 79.2 minutes.
Great.
Cooking with gas now, eh, Pat?
Someone said. Patrick bunched both his fists and made a revving noise with his mouth. That's great, really. I tried to look pleased for him. I had a drink, and then another. I listened to their talk of mileage, of the skinned knees and hypothermic swimming bouts. I tuned out and watched the other people in the pub, wondering about their lives. Each of them would have huge events in their own families. Babies loved and lost, dark secrets, great joys and tragedies. If they could put it into perspective, if they could just enjoy a sunny evening in a pub garden, then surely I should too. And then I told Patrick about Dad's job. His face looked a little like I imagined mine had. I had to repeat it, just so he could be sure he'd heard me right.
That's very cozy, you both working for him.
I wanted to tell him then, I really did. I wanted to explain that so much of everything was tied up in my battle to keep Will alive. I wanted to tell him how afraid I was that Will seemed to be trying to buy me my freedom. But I knew I could say nothing. I might as well get the rest of it over while I could. That's not the only thing. He says I can stay there when I want, in the spare room, to get past the whole bed problem at home. Patrick looked at me.
You're going to live at his house?
I might. It's a nice offer, Pat. You know what it's been like at home. And you're never here. I like coming to your house, but, well, if I'm honest, it doesn't feel like home. He was still staring at me.
Then make it home.
What?
Move in. Make it home. Put your stuff up. Bring your clothes. It's about time we moved in together.
It was only afterward, when I thought about it, that I realized he'd actually looked really unhappy as he said this. Not like a man who'd finally worked out that he couldn't live without his girlfriend close by him and wanted to make a joyous union of our two lives. He looked like someone who felt outmaneuvered.
You really want me to move in?
Yes, sure. He rubbed at his ear.
I mean, I'm not saying let's get married or anything, but it does make sense, right?
You old romantic.
I mean it, Lou. It's time. It's probably been time for ages, but I guess I've just been wrapped up in one thing and another.
Move in. It'll be good.
He hugged me.
It'll be really good. Around us, the triathlon terrors had diplomatically resumed their chatter. A small cheer went up as a group of Japanese tourists got the photograph they'd wanted. Birds sang, the sun dipped, the world turned. I wanted to be part of it, not stuck in a silent room, worrying about a man in a wheelchair. Yes, I said. It'll be good. Chapter 17. The worst thing about working as a caregiver isn't what you might think. It's not the lifting and cleaning, the medicines and wipes, and the distant but somehow always perceptible smell of disinfectant. It's not even the fact that most people assume you're only doing it because you really aren't smart enough to do anything else. It's the fact that when you spend all day in proximity to someone, there is no escape from their moods or your own. Will had been distant with me all morning, since I'd first told him my plans. It was nothing an outsider could have put their finger on, but there were fewer jokes, perhaps less casual conversation. He asked me nothing about the contents of the day's newspapers.
That's what you want to do?
His eyes had flickered, but his face betrayed nothing. I shrugged. Then I nodded more emphatically. I felt there was something childishly non-committal about my response. It's about time, really, I said. I mean, I am 27. He studied my face. Something tightened in his jaw. I felt suddenly unbearably tired. I felt this peculiar urge to say I was sorry, and I wasn't sure what for. He gave a little nod, raised a smile.
"Glad you've got it all sorted out," he said,
and wheeled himself into the kitchen. I was starting to feel really cross with him. I'd never felt as judged by anyone as I felt judged by Will now. It was as if my deciding to settle down with my boyfriend had made me less interesting to him, like I could no longer be his pet project. I couldn't say any of this to him, of course, but I was just as cool with him as he was with me. It was, frankly, exhausting. In the afternoon, there was a knock at the back door. I hurried down the corridor, my hands still wet from washing up, and opened it to find a man standing there in a dark suit, a briefcase in hand. "Oh, no, we're Buddhist," I said firmly, closing the door as the man began to protest. 2 weeks previously, a pair of Jehovah's Witnesses had kept Will captive at the back door for almost 15 minutes while he struggled to reverse his chair over the dislodged doormat. When I finally shut the door, they had called out that he, more than anyone, should understand what it was to look forward to the afterlife.
"I'm here to see Mr. Trainer," the man said, and I opened the door cautiously.
In all my time at Granter House, nobody had ever come to see Will via the back door.
"Let him in," Will said, appearing behind me. "I asked him to come."
When I still stood there, he added,
"It's okay, Clark. He's a friend."
The man stepped over the threshold, held out his hand, and shook mine.
"Michael Lawler," he said.
He was about to say something else, but Will moved his chair between us, effectively cutting off any further conversation.
"We'll be in the living room. Could you make some coffee, then leave us for a while?"
Okay. Mr. Lawler smiled at me, a little awkwardly, and followed Will into the living room. When I walked in with a tray of coffee some minutes later, they were discussing cricket. The conversation about legs and runs continued until I had no further reason to lurk. Brushing invisible dust from my skirt, I straightened up and said, "Well, I'll leave you to it."
"Thanks, Louisa."
"You sure you don't want anything else? A snack?"
"Thank you, Louisa."
Will never called me Louisa, and he'd never banished me from anything before. Mr. Lawler stayed almost an hour. I did my chores, then hung around in the kitchen, wondering if I was brave enough to eavesdrop. I wasn't. I sat, ate 2 bourbon creams, chewed my nails, listened to the low hum of their voices, and wondered for the 15th time why Will had asked this man not to use the front entrance. He didn't look like a doctor or a consultant. He could have been a financial advisor, but he somehow didn't have the right air about him. He certainly didn't look like a physiotherapist, occupational therapist, or dietitian, or one of the legions of other people employed by the local authority to pop by and assess Will's ever-changing needs. You could spot those a mile off. They always looked exhausted, but were briskly, determinedly cheerful. They wore woolens in muted colours with sensible shoes, and drove dusty estate cars full of folders and boxes of equipment. Mr. Lawler had a navy blue BMW. His gleaming 5 Series was not a local authority sort of a car. Finally, Mr. Lawler emerged. He closed his briefcase, and his jacket hung over his arm. He no longer looked awkward. I was in the hallway within seconds.
"Ah, would you mind pointing me toward the bathroom?"
I did so, mutely, and stood there fidgeting until he emerged.
"Right, so that's all for now. Thank you, Michael."
Will didn't look at me.
"I'll wait to hear from you." "I should be in touch later this week," Mr. Lawler said. "Email would be preferable to a letter, at least for now." "Yes, of course."
I opened the back door to see him out. Then, as Will disappeared back into the living room, I followed Lawler into the courtyard and said lightly, "So, do you have far to go?" His clothes were beautifully cut. They carried the sharp edge of the city in their tailoring, serious money in their thread count.
"London, unfortunately. Still, hope the traffic won't be too bad at this time of the afternoon."
The sun was high in the sky, and I had to squint to see him. "So, where in London are you based?"
"Regent Street."
"The Regent Street? Nice."
"Yes, not a bad place to be. Right. Thank you for the coffee, Miss
Clark, Louisa Clark." He stopped then and looked at me for a moment, and I wondered whether he had sussed my inadequate attempts to work out who he might be.
"Ah, Miss Clark," he said,
his professional smile swiftly reinstated.
"Thank you anyway."
He put his briefcase carefully on the back seat, climbed into his car, and was gone. That night I stopped off at the library on my way home to Patrick's. I could have used his computer, but I still felt obliged to ask, and this just seemed easier. I sat down and typed "Michael Lawler" and "Regent Street, London" into the search engine. "Knowledge is power, Will," I told him silently. There were 3,290 results, the first three of which revealed a Michael Lawler, practitioner at law, specialist in wills, probate, and power of attorney, based on that same street. I stared at the screen for a few minutes. Then I typed in his name again, this time against the search engine of images, and there he was, at some round table function, in a dark suit. Michael Lawler, specialist in wills and probate. The same man who had spent an hour with Will. I moved into Patrick's that night, in the hour and a half between my finishing work and his heading off to the track. I took everything except my bed and the new blinds. He arrived with his car, and we loaded my belongings into bin bags. Within 2 trips we had it all, barring my school books in the loft, at his. Mum cried. She thought she was forcing me out.
"For goodness sake, love, it's time she moved on.
She's 27 years old," my father told her.
"She's still my baby," she said, pressing 2 tins of fruitcake and a tote bag of cleaning products into my arms.
I didn't know what to say to her. I don't even like fruitcake. It was surprisingly easy, fitting my belongings into Patrick's flat. He had next to nothing anyway, and I had almost nothing from years spent in the box room. The only thing we fell out over was my CD collection, which apparently could only be combined with his once I had stickered the backs of mine and sorted them into alphabetical order.
"Make yourself at home," he kept saying,
as if I was some kind of guest. We were nervous, strangely awkward with each other, like 2 people on a first date. While I was unpacking, he brought me tea and said,
"I thought this could be your mug."
He showed me where everything lived in the kitchen, then said several times,
"Of course, put stuff where you want. I don't mind."
He had cleared 2 drawers and the wardrobe in the spare room. The other 2 drawers were filled with his fitness clothes. I didn't know there were so many permutations of lycra and fleece. My wildly colourful clothes left several feet of closet space still empty, the wire hangers jangling mournfully. "I'll have to buy more stuff just to fill it up," I said, looking at it. He laughed nervously. "What's that?" He looked at my calendar, tacked up on the spare room wall, with its ideas in green and its actual planned events in black. When something had worked, music, wine tasting, I put a smiley face next to it. When it hadn't, horse racing, art galleries, it stayed blank. There was little marked in for the next 2 weeks. Will had become bored of the places nearby, and as yet I couldn't persuade him to venture farther afield. I glanced over at Patrick. I could see him eyeing the August 12 date, which was now underlined with exclamation marks in black. It's just reminding me about my job.
You don't think they're going to renew your contract?
I don't know, Patrick. Patrick took the pen from its clip, looked at the next month, and scribbled under week 28, "Time to start job hunting."
"That way you're covered for whatever happens," he said.
He kissed me and left me to it. I laid out my creams carefully in the bathroom, tucked my razors, moisturizer, and tampons neatly into his mirrored cabinet. I put some books in a neat row along the spare room floor under the window, including the new titles that Will had ordered from Amazon for me. Patrick promised to put up some shelves when he had a spare moment. And then, as he left to go running, I sat and looked out over the industrial estate toward the castle and practiced saying the word home silently under my breath. I am pretty hopeless at keeping secrets. Trina says I touch my nose as soon as I even think of lying. It's a pretty straightforward giveaway. My parents still joke about the time I wrote absence notes for myself after bunking off school. "Dear Miss Trowbridge," they read, "please excuse Louisa Clark from today's lessons, as I am very poorly with women's problems." Dad had struggled to keep a straight face, even while he was supposed to be tearing a strip off me. Keeping Will's plan from my family had been one thing. I was good at keeping secrets from my parents. It's one of the things we learn while growing up, after all. But coping with the anxiety by myself was something else entirely. I spent the next couple of nights trying to work out what Will was up to, and what I could do to stop him, my thoughts racing even as Patrick and I chatted, cooking together in the little galley kitchen. I was already discovering new things about him, like he really did know 100 different things to do with turkey breast. At night we made love. It seemed almost obligatory at the moment, as if we should take full advantage of our freedom. It was like Patrick somehow felt I owed him something, given my constant physical proximity to Will. But as soon as he dropped off to sleep, I was lost in my thoughts again. There were just 7 weeks left, and Will was making plans, even if I wasn't. The following week, if Will noticed that I was preoccupied, he didn't say anything. We went through the motions of our daily routine. I took him for short drives into the country, cooked his meals, saw to him when we were in his house. He didn't make jokes about Running Man anymore. I talked to him about the latest books he had recommended. We discussed The English Patient, I had loved this, and a Swedish thriller, which I hadn't. We were solicitous with each other, almost excessively polite. I missed his insults, his crabbiness. Their absence just added to the looming sense of threat that hung over me. Nathan watched us both, as if he were observing some kind of new species.
"You two had a row?"
he asked me one day in the kitchen as I unpacked the groceries.
"You'd better ask him," I said.
"That's exactly what he said."
He looked at me sideways, and disappeared into the bathroom to unlock Will's medical cabinet. Meanwhile, I'd lasted 3 days after Michael Lawler's visit before I rang Mrs. Traynor. I asked if we could meet somewhere other than her house, and we agreed on a little cafe that had opened on the grounds of the castle. The same cafe, ironically, that had cost me my job. It was a much smarter affair than the Buttered Bun, all limed oak and bleached wood tables and chairs. It sold homemade soup full of actual vegetables and fancy cakes, and you couldn't buy a normal coffee, only lattes, cappuccinos and macchiatos. There were no builders or girls from the hairdressers. I sat nursing my tea and wondered about the dandelion lady and whether she would feel comfortable enough to sit in here and read a newspaper all morning. "Louisa, I'm sorry I'm late." Camilla Traynor entered briskly, her handbag tucked under her arm, dressed in a grey silk shirt and navy trousers. I felt the urge to stand up. There was never a time when I spoke to her that I didn't still feel like I was engaged in some kind of interview. I was held up in court. Sorry, to get you out of work, I mean. I just... well, I wasn't sure it could wait. She held up her hand and mouthed something at the waitress. Then she sat across from me. I felt her gaze as if I were transparent. "Will had a lawyer come to the house," I said. "I found out he's a specialist in wills and probate." I couldn't think of any gentler way to open the conversation. She looked as if I'd just smacked her in the face. I realized, too late, that she might actually have thought I'd have something good to tell her. "A lawyer? Are you sure?" "I looked him up on the internet. He's based on Regent Street, in London," I added unnecessarily. "His name's Michael Lawler." She blinked hard, as if trying to take this in.
"Did Will tell you this?"
"No. I don't think he wanted me to know. I got his name and looked him up." Her coffee arrived. The waitress put it on the table in front of her, but Mrs. Traynor didn't seem to notice. "Did you want anything else?" the girl said.
"No, thank you."
"We have carrot cake on special today. We make it here ourselves. It's got a lovely buttercream fill..." "No." Mrs. Traynor's voice was sharp. "Thank you." The girl stood there just long enough to let us know she was offended, and then stalked off, her notepad swinging conspicuously from one hand. "I'm sorry," I said. "You told me before that I should let you know anything important. I stayed awake half the night trying to work out whether to say anything." Her face looked almost leached of colour. I knew how she felt.
"How is he himself? Have you come up with any other ideas? Outings?"
"He's not keen." I told her about Paris and my list of things I had compiled. All the while I spoke, I could see her mind working ahead of me, calculating, assessing.
"Anywhere," she said finally. "I'll finance it. Any trip you want. I'll pay for you, for Nathan. Just see if you can get him to agree to it."
I nodded. "If there's anything else you can think of, just to buy us some time.
I'll pay your wages beyond the 6 months, obviously."
That's really not an issue." We finished our coffees in silence, both lost in our thoughts. As I watched her surreptitiously, I noticed that her immaculate hairstyle was now flecked with grey, her eyes as shadowed as my own. I realized I didn't feel any better for having told her, to have passed my own heightened anxiety on to her. But what choice did I have? The stakes were getting higher with every day that passed. The sound of the clock, striking 2, seemed to spur her out of her stasis. "I suppose I should get back to work." Please let me know anything that you can come up with, Louisa. It might be better if we had these conversations away from the annex. I stood up.
Oh, I said, you'll need my new number. I just moved.
As she reached into her handbag for a pen, I added, I moved in with Patrick, my boyfriend.
I don't know why this news surprised her so much. She looked startled, and then she handed me her pen.
I didn't know you had a boyfriend.
I didn't know I needed to tell you.
She stood, one hand resting on the table. Will mentioned the other day that you... He thought you might be moving into the annex, on weekends. I scribbled Patrick's home number.
Well, I thought it might be more straightforward for everyone if I moved in with Patrick.
I handed her the slip of paper. But I'm not far away, just by the industrial estate. It won't affect my hours or my punctuality. We stood there. Mrs. Traynor seemed agitated, her hand running through her hair, then reaching down for the chain around her neck. Finally, as if she couldn't help herself, she blurted out,
"Would it really have hurt you to have waited? Just a few weeks?"
"I'm sorry?"
"Will... I think Will is very fond of you."
She bit her lip.
I can't see how this really helps."
"Hold on. Are you telling me I shouldn't have moved in with my boyfriend?"
"I'm just saying that the timing is not ideal. Will is in a very vulnerable state. We're all doing our best to keep him optimistic. And you..."
"I what?" I could see the waitress watching us, her notepad stilled in her hand.
"I what? Dare to have a life away from work?"
She lowered her voice. "I am doing everything I can, Louisa, to stop this thing. You know the task we're facing. And I'm just saying that I wish, given the fact that he is very fond of you, that you had waited a while longer before rubbing your happiness in his face."
I could hardly believe what I was hearing. I felt the colour rise to my face and took a deep breath before I spoke again.
"How dare you suggest I would do anything to hurt Will's feelings? I have done everything," I hissed. "I have done everything I can think of. I've come up with ideas, got him out, talked to him, read to him, looked after him." My last words exploded out of my chest. "I've cleaned up after him. I've changed his bloody catheter. I've made him laugh. I've done more than your bloody family has done." Mrs. Traynor stood very still. She drew herself up to her full height, tucked her handbag under her arm. "I think this conversation has probably ended, Miss Clark."
"Yes. Yes, Mrs. Traynor. I think it probably has."
She turned and walked swiftly out of the cafe. When the door slammed shut, I realized I too was shaking. That conversation with Mrs. Traynor kept me jangling for the next couple of days. I kept hearing her words, the idea that I was rubbing my happiness in his face. I didn't think Will could be affected by anything that I did. When he had seemed disapproving about my decision to move in with Patrick, I'd thought it was about him not liking Patrick rather than any feelings he had for me. More important, I didn't think I'd looked particularly happy. At home, I couldn't shake this feeling of anxiety. It was like a low-level current running through me, and it fed into everything I did. I asked Patrick, "Would we have done this if my sister hadn't needed my room at home?" He looked at me as if I were daft. He leaned over and pulled me to him, kissing the top of my head. Then he glanced down.
"Do you have to wear these pajamas? I hate you in pajamas."
They're comfortable.
They look like something my mum would wear.
I'm not going to wear a corset and stockings every night just to keep you happy. And you're not answering my question.
I don't know. Probably. Yes.
But we weren't talking about it, were we?
Lou, most people move in with each other because it's sensible. You can love someone and still see the financial and practical advantages.
I just don't want you to think I made this happen. I don't want to feel like I made this happen.
He sighed and rolled onto his back.
Why do women always have to go over and over a situation until it becomes a problem?
I love you. You love me. We've been together nearly 7 years, and there was no room at your parents' house anymore. It's actually pretty simple.
But it didn't feel simple. It felt like I was living a life I hadn't had a chance to anticipate.
That Friday, it rained all day. Warm, heavy sheets of it, like we were in the tropics, making the guttering gurgle and bowing the stems of the flowering shrubs as if in supplication. Will stared out of the windows like a dog denied a walk. Nathan came and went, a plastic bag lifted above his head. Will watched a documentary about penguins, and afterward, while he logged onto his computer, I busied myself so that we didn't have to talk to each other. I felt our discomfort with each other keenly, and being in the same room as him all the time made it that much worse. I had finally begun to understand the consolations of cleaning. I mopped, cleaned windows and changed duvets. I was a constant whirl of activity. No dust mite escaped my eye, no tea ring my forensic attentions. I was dislodging the lime scale on the bathroom taps, using paper towels soaked in vinegar, my mother's tip, when I heard Will's chair behind me.
What are you doing?
I was bent low over the bath. I didn't turn around. I'm descaling your taps. I could feel him watching me.
Say that again, he said after a beat.
What?
Say that again.
I straightened up.
Why? Are you having problems with your hearing? I'm descaling your taps.
No, I just want you to listen to what you're saying. There is no reason to descale my taps, Clark.
My mother won't notice it, I won't care, and it's making the bathroom stink like a fish and chips shop. Besides, I'd like to go out. I wiped a lock of hair from my face. It was true. There was a definite waft of large haddock in the atmosphere. Come on. It's finally stopped raining. I just spoke to my dad. He said he'll give us the keys to the castle after 5 o'clock, once all the tourists are out. I didn't feel great about the idea of us having to make polite conversation during a walk around the grounds, but the thought of being out of the annex was appealing. Okay, give me 5 minutes. I need to try and get the smell of vinegar off my hands. The difference between growing up like me and growing up like Will was that he wore his sense of entitlement lightly. I think if you grow up as he had done, with wealthy parents, in a nice house, if you go to good schools and nice restaurants as a matter of course, you probably just have this sense that good things will fall into place, that your position in the world is naturally an elevated one. Will had escaped into the empty grounds of the castle his whole childhood, he said. His dad let him roam the place, trusting him not to touch anything. After 5:30 p.m., when the last of the tourists had gone, as the gardeners began to trim and tidy, as the cleaners emptied the bins and swept up the empty cartons of drink and commemorative toffee fudge, it had become his private playground. First girl I ever kissed was in front of the drawbridge, he said, slowing to look toward it as we walked along the gravel path.
Did you tell her it was your place?
No.
Perhaps I should have. She dumped me a week later for the boy who worked in the mini-mart.
I turned and stared at him in shock. Not Terry Rowlands.
Dark, slick-back hair, tattoos up to his elbows.
He raised an eyebrow.
That's him.
He still works there, you know,
in the mini-mart, if that makes you feel any better.
I'm not sure he'd feel entirely envious of where I ended up, Will said, and I stopped talking again. It was strange seeing the castle like this, in silence, the two of us the only people there apart from the odd gardener in the distance. Instead of gazing at the tourists, being distracted by their accents and their alien lives, I found myself looking at the castle for perhaps the first time, beginning to absorb some of its history. Its flinted walls had stood there for more than 800 years. People had been born and died there, hearts filled and broken. Now, in the silence, you could almost hear their voices, their own footsteps on the path.
"Okay, confession time," I said. "Did you ever walk around here and pretend secretly that you were some kind of warrior prince?"
Will looked sideways at me.
"Honestly?"
"Of course."
"Yes. I even borrowed one of the swords off the walls of the Great Hall once. It weighed a ton. I remember being petrified that I wouldn't be able to lift it back onto its stand."
We had reached the swell of the hill, and from here, at the front of the moat, we could look down the long sweep of grass to the ruined wall that had marked the boundary. Beyond it lay the town, the neon signs and queues of traffic, the bustle that marked the rush hour. Up here it was silent, apart from the birds and the soft hum of Will's chair. He stopped the chair briefly and swiveled it so that we looked down at the grounds.
"I'm surprised we never met each other," he said. "When I was growing up, I mean. Our paths must have crossed."
"Why would they? We didn't exactly move in the same circles. And I would just have been the baby you passed in the pram while swinging your sword."
"Ah, I forgot. I am positively ancient compared to you."
8 years would definitely have qualified you as an older man," I said. "Even when I was a teenager, my dad would never have let me go out with an older man."
"Not even if he had his own castle?"
"Well, that would change things, obviously." The sweet smell of the grass rose up around us as we walked, Will's wheels hissing through the clear puddles on the path. I felt relieved. Our conversation wasn't quite as it had been, but perhaps that was only to be expected. Mrs. Traynor had been right. It would always be hard for Will to watch other people moving on with their lives. I made a mental note to think more carefully about how my actions might make an impact on his life. I didn't want to be angry anymore.
"Let's do the maze. I haven't done it for ages."
I was pulled back from my thoughts. "Oh, no thanks." I glanced over, noticing suddenly where we were.
"Why? Are you afraid of getting lost? Come on, Clark, it'll be a challenge for you. See if you can memorize the route you take in, then take the reverse one out. I'll time you. I used to do it all the time."
I glanced back toward the house. "I'd really rather not." Even the thought of it had brought a knot to my stomach.
"Ah, playing it safe again."
"That's not it."
"No problem. We'll just take our boring little walk and go back to the boring little annex."
I knew he was joking, but something in his tone really got to me. I thought of my parents, my sister with her big new life. Mine was to be the small life, my ambitions the petty ones. I glanced over at the maze, at its dark, dense box hedging. I was being ridiculous. Perhaps I'd been behaving ridiculously for years. It was all over, after all.
and I was moving on.
Just remember which turn you take, then reverse it to come out. It's not as hard as it looks, really.
I left him on the path before I could think about it. I took a breath and walked in past the sign that warned no unaccompanied children, striding briskly between the dark, damp hedging which still glistened with raindrops.
It's not so bad. It's not so bad, I found myself murmuring under my breath. It's just a load of old hedges.
I took a right turn, then a left through a break in the hedge. I took another right, a left, and as I went, I rehearsed in my head the reverse of where I'd been. Right, left, break, right, left. My heart rate began to rise a little, so that I could hear the blood pumping in my ears. I forced myself to think about Will on the other side of the hedge, glancing down at his watch. It was just a silly test. I was no longer that naive young woman. I was 27. I lived with my boyfriend. I had a responsible job. I was a different person. I turned, went straight on, and turned again. And then, almost from nowhere, the panic rose within me like bile. I thought I saw a man darting at the end of the hedge. Even though I told myself it was just my imagination, the act of reassuring myself made me forget my reversed instructions. Right, left, break, right. Right? Had I got that the wrong way around? My breath caught in my throat. I forced myself onward, only to realize that I'd completely lost my bearings. I stopped and glanced around me at the direction of the shadows, trying to work out which direction was west. And as I stood there, it dawned on me that I couldn't do it. I couldn't stay in there. I whipped around and began to walk in what I thought was a southerly direction. I would get out. I was 27 years old. It was fine. But then I heard their voices, the catcalling, the mocking laughter. I saw them darting in and out of the gaps in the hedge, felt my own feet sway drunkenly under my high heels, the unforgiving prickle of the hedge as I fell against it, trying to steady myself. I want to get out now, I told them, my voice slurring and unsteady. I've had enough, guys. And they had all vanished. The maze was silent, just the distant whispers that might have been them on the other side of the hedge, or might have been the wind dislodging the leaves. I want to go out now, I had said, my voice sounding uncertain even to me. I had gazed up at the sky, briefly unbalanced by the vast, studded black of the space above me. And then I jumped as someone caught me around my waist, the dark-haired one, the one who had been to Africa. "You can't go yet," he said. "You'll spoil the game." I'd known then, just from the feel of his hands on my waist. I had realized that some balance had shifted, that some restraint on behavior had begun to evaporate. And I had laughed, pushed at his hands as if they were a joke, unwilling to let him know that I knew. I heard him shout for his friends, and I broke away from him, running suddenly, trying to fight my way to the exit, my feet sinking into the damp grass. I heard them all around me, their raised voices, their bodies unseen, and felt my throat constrict in panic. I was too disorientated to work out where I was. The tall hedges kept swaying, pitching toward me. I kept going, pushing my way around corners, stumbling, ducking into openings, trying to get away from their voices. But the exit never came. Everywhere I turned, there was just another expanse of hedge, another mocking voice. I stumbled into an opening, briefly exultant that I was near freedom. But then I saw I was back at the center again. Back where I had started. I reeled as I saw them all standing there, as if they'd simply been waiting for me. "There you go," one of them said, as his hand grabbed my arm.
"I told you she was up for it."
"Come on, Lulu. Give me a kiss and I'll show you the way out." His voice was soft and drawling.
"Give us all a kiss and we'll all show you the way out."
Their faces were a blur.
I just want you to...
"Come on, Lou. You like me, don't you? You've been sitting on my lap all evening. One kiss, how hard is that?" I heard a snigger.
"And you'll show me how to get out?"
My voice sounded pathetic, even to me. "Just one." He moved closer. I felt his mouth on mine, a hand squeezing my thigh. He broke away, and I heard the tenor of his breathing change.
"And now Jake's turn."
I don't know what I said then. Someone had my arm. I heard the laughter, felt a hand in my hair, another mouth on mine, insistent, invasive, and then...
"Will!"
I was sobbing now, crouched over myself.
"Will!"
I was saying his name over and over again, my voice ragged, emerging somewhere from my chest. I heard him somewhere far off, beyond the hedge.
"Louisa? Louisa, where are you? What's the matter?"
I was in the corner, as far under the hedge as I could get. Tears blurred my eyes, my arms wrapped tightly around me. I couldn't get out. I would be stuck here forever. Nobody would find me.
"Will! Where are..."
And there he was, in front of me.
"I'm sorry,"
I said, looking up, my face contorted.
"I'm sorry. I can't do it."
He lifted his arm a couple of inches, the maximum he could manage.
"Oh, Jesus, what the... Come here, Clark."
He moved forward, then glanced down at his arm in frustration.
"Bloody useless thing. It's okay. Just breathe. Come here. Just breathe. Slowly."
I wiped my eyes. At the sight of him, the panic had begun to subside. I stood up unsteadily and tried to straighten my face.
"I'm sorry. I don't know what happened."
"Are you claustrophobic?"
His face, inches from mine, was etched with worry.
"I could see you didn't want to go in. I just thought you were being..."
I shut my eyes.
"I just want to go now."
"Hold on to my hand. We'll go out."
He had me out of there within minutes. He knew the maze backward, he told me as we walked, his voice calm, reassuring. It had been a challenge for him as a boy to learn his way through. I entwined my fingers with his and felt the warmth of his hand as something comforting. I felt foolish when I realized how close to the entrance I'd been all along. We stopped at a bench just outside, and I rummaged in the back of his chair for a tissue. We sat there in silence, me on the end of the bench beside him, both of us waiting for my hiccuping to subside. He sat, sneaking sideways glances at me.
"So?" he said finally, when I must have looked as if I could speak without falling apart again. "You want to tell me what's going on?"
I twisted the tissue in my hands. "I can't." He closed his mouth. I swallowed. "It's not you," I said hurriedly. "I haven't talked to anyone about... It's stupid. And a long time ago, I didn't think I would..." I felt his eyes on me and wished he wouldn't look. My hands wouldn't stop trembling, and my stomach felt as if it were made of a million knots.
I shook my head, trying to tell him that there were things I couldn't say. I wanted to reach for his hand again, but I didn't feel I could. I was conscious of his gaze, could almost hear his unspoken questions. Below us, two cars had pulled up near the gates. Two figures got out. From here it was impossible to see who, and embraced. They stood there for a few minutes, perhaps talking, and then got back into their cars and drove off in the opposite direction. I watched them, but I couldn't think. My mind felt frozen. I didn't know what to say about anything anymore.
"Okay, here's the thing," he said finally.
I turned around, but he wasn't looking at me.
"I'll tell you something that I never tell anyone. All right?"
"All right." I screwed the tissue into a ball in my hands, waiting. He took a deep breath.
"I get really, really scared of how this is going to go." He let that settle in the air between us. And then, in a low, calm voice, he carried on. "I know most people think living like me is about the worst thing that could happen. But it could get worse. I could end up not being able to breathe by myself, not being able to talk. I could get circulatory problems that mean my limbs have to be amputated. I could be hospitalized indefinitely. This isn't much of a life, Clark. But when I think about how much worse it could get, some nights I lie in my bed and I can't actually breathe."
He swallowed.
"And you know what? Nobody wants to hear that stuff. Nobody wants you to talk about being afraid, or in pain, or being scared of dying through some stupid random infection. Nobody wants to know how it feels to know you will never have sex again, never eat food you've made with your own hands again, never hold your own child. Nobody wants to know that sometimes I feel so claustrophobic, being in this chair. I just want to scream like a madman at the thought of spending another day in it. My mother's hanging on by a thread and can't forgive me for still loving my father. My sister resents me for the fact that yet again I've overshadowed her. And because my injuries mean she can't properly hate me, like she has since we were children. My father just wants it all to go away. Ultimately, they want to look on the bright side. They need me to look on the bright side."
He paused.
"They need to believe there is a bright side."
I blinked into the darkness.
"Do I do that?" I said quietly. "You, Clark,"
he looked down at his hands,
"are the only person I felt able to talk to since I ended up in this bloody thing."
And so I told him. I reached for his hand, the same one that had led me out of the maze, and I looked straight down at my feet, and I took a breath, and I told them about the whole night, and how they'd laughed at me and made fun of how drunk and stoned I was, and how I'd passed out, and later my sister had said it might actually be a good thing, the not remembering all of what they'd done, but how that half hour of not knowing had haunted me ever since. I filled it, you see. I filled it with their laughter, their bodies, and their words. I filled it with my own humiliation. I told him how I saw their faces every time I went anywhere beyond the town, and how Patrick and Mum and Dad and my small life had been just fine for me, with all their problems and limitations. They had let me feel safe. By the time we finished talking, the sky had grown dark, and there were 14 messages on my mobile phone wondering where we were.
"You don't need me to tell you it wasn't your fault," he said quietly.
Above us, the sky had become endless and infinite. I twisted the tissue in my hand. Yes, well, I still feel responsible. I drank too much to show off. I was a terrible flirt. I was...
No. They were responsible.
Nobody had ever said those words aloud to me. Even Trina's look of sympathy had held some mute accusation. Well, if you will get drunk and silly with men you don't know... His fingers squeezed mine. A faint movement. But there it was.
Louisa, it wasn't your fault.
I cried then, not sobbing this time. The tears left me silently and told me something else was leaving me. Guilt, fear, a few other things I hadn't yet found words for. I leaned my head gently on his shoulder, and he tilted his head until it rested against mine.
Right. Are you listening to me?
I murmured a yes.
Then I'll tell you something good, he said.
And then he waited, as if he wanted to be sure he had my attention.
Some mistakes just have greater consequences than others. But you don't have to let that night be the thing that defines you.
I felt his head still pressed against mine.
You, Clark, have the choice not to let that happen.
The sigh that left me then was long and shuddering. We sat there in silence, letting his words sink in. I could have stayed there all night, above the rest of the world, the warmth of Will's hand in mine, feeling the worst of myself slowly begin to ebb away.
We'd better get back, he said eventually, before they call out a search party.
I released his hand and stood, a little reluctantly, feeling the cool breezes on my skin. And then, almost luxuriously, I stretched my arms high above my head. I let my fingers straighten in the evening air. The tension of weeks, months, perhaps years, easing a little, and let out a deep breath. Below me the lights of the town winked, a circle of light amid the black countryside below us. I turned back toward him. Will?
Yes?
I could barely see him in the dim light, but I knew he was watching me. Thank you. Thank you for coming to get me. He shook his head and turned his chair back toward the path. Chapter 18.
Disney World is good.
I told you, no theme parks. I know you said that, but it's not just roller coasters and whirling teacups. In Florida, you've got the film studios and the science center. It's actually quite educational. I don't think a 35-year-old former company head needs educating.
There are disabled loos on every corner, and the members of the staff are incredibly caring. Nothing's too much trouble.
You're going to say there are rides especially for handicapped people next, aren't you?
They accommodate everyone. Why don't you try Florida, Miss Clark? If you don't like it, you could go on to SeaWorld, and the weather's lovely.
In Will versus Killer Whale, I think I know who'd come off worst. He didn't seem to hear me.
And they're one of the top-rated companies for dealing with disability. You know, they do a lot of Make-A-Wish Foundation stuff for people who are dying.
He is not dying! I put the phone down on the travel agent just as Will came in. I fumbled with the receiver, trying to set it back in its cradle, and snapped my notepad shut.
Everything all right, Clark?
Fine, I smiled brightly.
Good. Got a nice frock?
What?
What are you doing on Saturday? He was waiting expectantly. My brain was still stalled on killer whale versus travel agent.